Hey everyone, I'm Jason V, and welcome to Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. My guest today is food justice consultant Sasha Jones. She's responsible for running the Afaya Community Garden in West Baltimore, which provides fresh produce to the neighborhood. We're going to talk about urban farming, sustainability, and how growing your own food can empower you as a consumer. Sasha, welcome to Local Color.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good.
Okay. You having a good day so far?
Yeah, I just actually came from the garden, so we had a pretty fun work day today.
What's going on at the garden?
We're preparing for winter right now, so it felt like menial tasks, but not really. We were weeding some of the beds that were summer beds, so we pulled out the rest of our watermelons and counted. I think we got about 8 today, which was pretty cool.
Summer beds, what does that mean?
So, you know, there are a few, like when people say eat seasonal, so it's, you know, the different seasons of planting and growing. So you have like early spring to mid spring, you have spring, summer, fall and winter.
Okay.
So we just pulled out, we've been pulling out our spring and summer crops, which are like squash, eggplant, watermelons, tomatoes. Some of those things are still going, and some of them we've been getting some frost, so they're starting to die.
So are you taking the plant out or like the root? Just the root?
Yeah, so the whole plant. So we're harvesting whatever is left that's edible, and then we're pulling the whole root stock out of the ground and kind of tilling it over.
Okay.
Yeah, so the bed that we pull stuff out of today, we're going to plant some garlic in a couple days.
Okay.
And the others will be cover cropping and just letting them kind of chill out for the wintertime.
Okay, that's good. Let me just turn up our levels a little bit more. Okay, cool. So let's talk about your beginning. You know, I mean, if you want to start from, you know, when you were a kid, but tell us about yourself. Where are you from?
I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay.
Born and raised. Actually, I'm born and raised in Northwest Baltimore, where I work.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, I've been around the world just to come back home.
where around the world?
I went to school in Atlanta, so I was there for 4 years in school, and then I spent an extra year. I actually got employed by my school, so I stayed there an extra year. And while I was in college and a little bit before, I went to Nicaragua.
You went to Nicaragua?
Yeah, I've been there twice. I went to Ecuador. I went to Ghana, and I'm preparing to go to Costa Rica in December.
That's amazing. What did you do in those countries?
Actually, that kind of what got me into this work. My Nicaragua trips were the first ones that I took. I went on it's an organization called Bridges to Community. And basically what they do is they provide a platform for young people to take service trips to Nicaraguan communities. And I was additionally a part of a group called Be More Culture, which was led by my art teacher in high school. And she is a Nicaraguan citizen, and she came here during their civil war in the late 70s. And so she organized, in addition to us going to do that service trip, we mostly studied the connection between impoverished youth, you know, which were ourselves in Baltimore, and impoverished youth in Nicaragua, and, you know, what were the differences and similarities between those. So while we were there, we had a lot of like conversations and chill time. But then we painted a few murals, built a couple latrines, taught at schools. The second time we went, it was more art-based, so we did a tour of Esteli, which is like a artist community, and we saw, they have a bunch of murals there, so we went to this museum that kind of serves as a hub, and then we traveled and met some artists, and one of my friends, who I'm still friends with to this day, he is actually an artist. He does really amazing work, and our birthdays are 10, we're 10 days apart.
You guys were almost birthday.
I know, exactly. So he calls me his gemela, which is twin in Spanish. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, did you meet him while you were traveling, or did you know him from school in Baltimore?
No. So he's like, he might be 10 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
So he's older, but I met him on our trips, and he was with our tour group each year that we went. So we were able to kind of build our relationship through that and just keep in contact. So yeah, that's what I did in Nicaragua. And then Ecuador, I went with my college, and it was just a learning trip to accelerate me finishing my minor in Spanish.
Oh, so you can speak Spanish fluently?
Sometimes.
When the situation calls for it.
We'll see what happens when I get to Costa Rica. I'm like, hola. Como estás?
No. Right, you're like, oh, listen to this gringo.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but so yeah, I studied Spanish a lot. When I first went to Nicaragua, I had only probably taken one Spanish class.
Yeah.
And then by the time I got to Ecuador, I had gone through high school Spanish and college Spanish, and so I was a little bit more proficient and comfortable.
Okay.
But I always shy away from speaking it. I always feel like, you know, kind of weird just assuming that someone speaks Spanish because they look like they speak Spanish.
Yeah, I know how that goes. I was in Puerto Rico a couple of years ago with my family, and it's always hard because when you know a different language and you go to the country, you wanna try Spanish or whatever language,
right.
And then the other people are just like, I know English, please.
Exactly.
Stop. Like, let's make this easier for
right.
both of us.
What are you just trying to say? Like,
yeah,
spit
yeah,
it
yeah.
out.
Exactly.
Exactly. So they're always trying to practice their English. But okay. Yeah, I had a good time on both those trips. And Ghana was another college trip later on in college. And that's when I was kind of getting more into, you know, what I was interested in. And so all of my trips have kind of, I'm a huge proponent of travel because you learn way more about yourself than you ever can about, you know, the other place when you're there. You really can't learn a huge amount in 3 weeks or, you know, even 4 months, there's still tons to learn.
Right.
But each of my trips, like, really opened my eyes to just how different things in the world were and how poverty is shaped a lot by geography and resilience to the land. And so that's how I started to study like sustainability and really getting into sustainable agriculture. So by the time I went to Ghana, I was on domestic exchange at American
University.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we went to Ghana as a kind of a case study trip on my course was international environment and development. So Ghana is one of like not only the burgeoning and most stable economies in Africa, but it's also really on the front end of making sure that the nation is growing sustainably. So making sure that there are avenues for waste and using entrepreneurship as a way to kind of bring people into the economy as well as reduce all of the ills that can come with growth like we've seen in this country, which is why everyone's talking about, you know, emissions and
going green.
Exactly,
like
going
that.
Green and all that stuff. So, you know, other countries are not going to have the benefit of being terrible citizens of the world for 100 years before they get to act together. So
we went to
Ghana to kind of we went to a bunch of different like community organizations and the embassies and different stuff like that to see what people were doing and all the different ways in which you can build a sustainable economy that is strong enough to lift people out of poverty, but then also is not making, you know, killing the land in the same vein. So that's where I've been so far.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Do you think the United States could learn anything from Ghana?
You know, the United States government probably is not interested in learning anything from Ghana. But, you know, and it's really sad to say, but seriously, you know, and that's just kind of the privilege of developed countries to think that they're always in the teaching position and not the learning position.
Right.
But people, you know, one reason why I do farm is because it's something that's grassroots, something that anybody can participate in and really see a change in their immediate life or the lives of the people in the communities around them. So one of the most exciting things that I saw in Ghana, and it's really basic, but there's an organization, Global Mamas, which Global Mamas is actually based here out of the United States.
Okay.
So you can, you
is
know.
Is it an NGO?
No, it's a social enterprise.
Oh, okay.
So basically what they do is they gather up Ghanaian women, and pretty much every woman in Ghana grows up with a skill. or they learn one because they're moving from rural environments to urban environments. And so a lot of people learn sewing, you know, and don't know what to do with it. I mean, how many people can you make clothes for in your own neighborhood? So the cap is really low. And so what Global Mamas has done is kind of convened all these women together and have them making clothes and like different items, and they export them to different parts of the world. And that's kind of something that's happening a lot. There are a few different companies that are operating that way. Global Mamas, they do the same price in U.S. and Ghanaian currency. So Ghanaian CDs are, I think, $1.50 that lesser value.
CD is the currency?
It's CEDI. The Ghanaian dollars are, they have a lower value than United States dollars, but you buy it, it's 26 USD, 26, you know, GHC, which is.
Really?
Yeah, so they, you know, they make it affordable for the people there and for the people here.
That's good.
But then one of the, I brought back like a little change purse, and it was made out of plastic bags, because anytime you buy something in Ghana, you get it and it's like this black plastic bag. And this is true in much of West Africa and probably all of Africa. And even in South America too, I've seen the same thing. So then you have like plastic bags. Like we have tumbleweave here, and we also just have plastic bags just flying around.
Yeah.
But what they have done is allow like children to collect those bags, and then, you know, the women, they kind of weave them. And so they turn out to be like this really, you know, water resistant, really durable fiber that they can use to make all types of stuff. So for us, you know, especially for me or anybody that I know in Park Heights, you know, all of the hoods and ghettos of the United States could definitely use something like that to collect all those plastic bags that are trapped in trees and under your car
and in the gutter,
the garden, and start to put those together and make things out of them. And I thought that was so, you know, brilliant. I mean, it's not novel, it's not new, but it's just something that we can do and something that we can learn from the innovations that are happening in the developing world.
You touched on it a little bit earlier about how you got introduced to farming going to all these other countries, but is it true, or can you shed some light on what is it? Like, don't you have to be certified or like take a class in order to be a food justice consultant?
Well, you don't have to, but it kind of helps. You know, so many of us that have the interest may or may not be connected to the expertise.
Okay.
So there are a few different like apprenticeships and training programs that you can go through. I did the beginner farmer training program here in Maryland, and that's led through Future Harvest CASA. And what they do is you have 9 to 13 weeks of classroom time. So you learn like budgeting, soil select, you know, seed selection, how to get soil samples, you know, the nitty gritty details that no one really, you know, will teach
that you. Don't think about when you think
exactly, exactly.
Okay.
So, you know, they really teach you the farming as a business. And then from March to November, you do one day a week with a mentor farmer. And so you're out there doing application, actually, you know, seeing how these other farmers make it work for themselves. Because everybody has a different model. Everybody, you know, takes data differently. Everybody sends stuff to market differently. They have different CSAs. So I did that last year. I also did the Master Gardener Certification Program, which is through, well, here's the University of Maryland Extension, but it's a national program. And so you can get certified as a Master Gardener, which basically says that you are the master at your garden, which no one can actually be. So it's, you know, it's set up the same way to offer different classroom based. You get this really thick book, which is the best part of the class, and it's like a reference material. So anytime you have a problem, whether it's pests or soil or you know, nutrients, there's a fix in there. So programs like that really help. When I was in Atlanta, I did an internship with Global Growers, which is a farm that serves the refugee community.
Yeah.
So we actually have a project like that here in Baltimore, and I just found out about it. But when I was working with them, you'd be surprised like how many refugee communities there are in the United States. And basically, when someone applies for asylum, they will send you to like one of like four different places in the U.S. Oh, there are more than four, but basically they're already pre-constructed communities where, you know, they send folks. So this particular community was full of women from Burundi. And so I worked on a farm enterprise there. that served, you know, we had, what was that guy from? Oh, Bhutan. So he was, we had a fellow from Bhutan. We had women from Burundi. There was an influx of Latin American folks in there too. So that farm was really attempting, and any project like this is attempting to reconnect farmers from other places to their livelihood, and it really helps the transition. So I did that, and I also volunteered at Truly Living Well Urban Farm, also in Atlanta, and they have an apprenticeship that they'll pay you. So if anyone is interested, look up Truly Living Well, and they have a, I think it's like a 10-month apprenticeship. It's full application. So you have classes every other Saturday, but then you're out there on their farm 3 times a week. So if you have the privilege to quit your job and just, you know, do it for those yeah. months, you know, it may be only be 4 months, but yeah, if you have the opportunity to do it, they help you find housing and they do pay you a stipend, so it's not completely disengaging from life for that time. But yeah, programs like that are great, because the way it is, farming is a lifetime job. You're born into it. You can't really learn. That's why a beginning farmer is anyone who's been farming for less than 10 years. So it takes 10 years.
Less than 10 years.
So it takes at least 10 years for you to even be credible as a farmer for
really?
Anyone. Exactly. So like, I'm still like a baby, you know, I'm in year like, I've been leading this project for 2 full years,
right.
and have been like volunteering and working on different farms for the past 4. And
how
I'm still, a novice. I'm still like, oh, you know, if anyone asks me, I'm like, huh, you know, I can tell you this, but maybe
right,
not that
but
much
it might
about
be
it.
Wrong.
Exactly.
So ask somebody else.
Exactly, like ask an elder. Like, like everybody just needs an elder to ask, and that's what apprenticeship and training programs really help you connect you with those people who have been doing it a little bit longer than you.
Okay. Do you think that farming and sustainability go hand in hand?
Oh, definitely. That's how, I mean, that was my academic interest. So there's like this compound story effort of how, you know, I got into this work. One being, you know, my travel abroad and just seeing the importance of being able to sustain yourself from the land and having agency, because so many people that I encountered really relied on their governments to sustain them. And as
when you say agency, do you mean independence?
Yeah, and okay. Not only independence, but self-will, mobility.
Gotcha.
So having the get up and go, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, even though we know that's next to impossible to pick yourself up.
Right.
You have to start moving at least.
You have to at least to want to do it.
Exactly.
Okay,
so
okay.
People that understand, you know, that they can change their realities.
Right.
And start working toward that. So I met a lot of people who, while they may have had that, they really didn't have the climate. And by what I mean by is like the social climate, not the environmental climate, because that was one of the most astounding things to me, that you have like this beautiful tropical environment where you can grow so many things and nobody's growing anything.
Right.
You know, or the basic things like coffee or cacao, like really high cash crops that there's just no infrastructure for in a lot of these countries, that, you know, they can be getting paid and they're just not.
You're right.
So that was one part of it. Another part was my personal and family health, you know, and just watching folks just die, you know, and be sick all the time.
Yeah.
But then when I was in school, I'm like, okay, I study international studies. So I'm just like, why is this, you know, a thing? You know, like, why are people in agriculture? Why are economies based on agriculture? And none of these products are getting to market, you know? So like, how
gotcha,
is this
gotcha.
A thing? How, you know, is the majority of the world, almost 80%, you know, surviving with subsistence agriculture, and it's subsistence. They're not using it. They're not growing cash crops. They're not getting it to market. There's just these, all of these challenges. And so I set out to learn, you know, what sustainable agriculture is. Like, a lot of us in our generation don't know about the Green Revolution, which is when, I see that look on your face, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So talk about that.
So basically, the Green Revolution is when what we know now as conventional agriculture took over as conventional agriculture. And so, you know, prior to that, we see all these memes talking about, you know, organic is the only way. We just started using pesticides, all that, blah, 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 right? Like, all, okay. You know, all the talk,
yeah.
Which is true.
Okay.
You know, so in the I want to say the 70s, it might even be the 50s. I'm terrible at dates. But basically, all these scientists got together and they said, how can we improve yields and lower costs? Income, you know, so then they figured it out. So they entered in pesticides, herbicides, resistant crop strains, and they sent all this stuff out to the developing world to try out. And so they planted all these plants. They put all these inputs in them. It was super expensive. They grew a crop. It was great. Then they realized that, oh, shoot, you know, this just polluted all our waterways. It's right. really expensive. So we've been on that loop since then of producing food in this really expensive way that's efficient, but it doesn't serve anyone but the person who's processing it and pushing it out, because the grower doesn't get paid. The worker certainly doesn't get paid. You know, the country is barely taking any revenue from that GDP because there's so many tax breaks and cuts. You know, there's a whole system that's out there, you know, against people, against developing nations to kind of keep them down. It's really sad, but it's true. And so how do we get people from being in this loop is what I wanted to study. So how do we use agriculture, because that's what their economies are based off of anyway? You know, how do we make it more sustainable, reduce the cost, increase the yields, and make it healthier for the people themselves? Because then you get all these birth defects and all this stuff. So, you know, it's when you look at it in all of the sectors that's involved, it just feels like this huge, huge, huge problem. Like, you know, what can I do? What can lowly me do? So what I did was just start working, you know, like you can't really, you'll never have enough money to sue the World Bank. So, you know, or IFP, you yeah. know, or, you know, anyone, they're all in on it. So where, you know, I said, okay, well, my interest was abroad and traveling, and I love that. But there were people here, you know, back at home who needed the same information, needed the same resources to lift themselves out of poverty or to, at minimum, reduce their grocery bill.
Right.
And so here I am.
Following up on that and sustainability and farming, let's say somebody in the city, like West Baltimore, East Baltimore, really doesn't matter where, but somebody who lives in an urban environment wants to get started and live a more healthy and sustainable lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Where should they start?
Well, if I should give a shameless plug.
Okay.
No, you can start by coming to Brassica Fest, which is the final event that we put on November 21st, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. But basically that event is to answer your question that you just asked. So if I want to do this, where do I start?
Right.
So we organized this event. Brassicas are the plant family that includes collards, kale, mustards, turnips, rutabaga, broccoli, cauliflower, pretty much every vegetable that you see in the grocery store and eat.
Exactly. Okay.
And have eaten your entire life. It's this huge plant family. You can either call it the mustard family, you can call it cruciferous vegetables, but they're really nutrient rich. All of them are superfoods and they're really close to us. We all have grown up eating them. So we use this plant family as a platform to talk about food as medicine. But then we talk in a larger context about, you know, growing your own food, about knowing the rules and regulations on, you know, growing food or keeping chickens or goats or bees or whatever your heart's desire.
Right.
You know, so the event this year is broken down into three tracks, which will be building a just and equitable economy. So that's talking about community organizing. So if you want to change your community, you know, where do you start? So we're going to be talking about how to talk to people, how to build relationships, you know, how to figure out where your assets are in your community, that sort of thing. Then we have a track called Eat to Live, which is going to be all of the information about the food. So if you want to eat raw, if you want to eat vegan, if you want to transition your child from a junk food diet, make healthy snacks at home, all of those things will be in that track. And then we have a homesteading track, which, you know, for the people who know all this information and they're ready to go to the next level, where do I start? So we'll be doing workshops on container gardening, building raised beds at your home. We're doing a bee workshop on keeping bees, harvesting the honey. So there's a lot of information there at that event. If you don't want to come to Brassica Fest, you can call us and, you know, we'll walk you through all this information. But then also, you know, outside of me or our organization, there's tons of resources out there. So the BaltimoreCity.gov website, their sustainability page, the Baltimore Office of Sustainability, has a lot of resources. One, the Adopt a Lot program. So if you don't have space to grow at home, you can adopt a lot. If you live near a vacant lot and it's not currently on the Adopt a Lot list, if you reach out to the, if you attempt to reach out to the landowner and they don't respond to you within a certain amount of time, you can just take it.
Really?
You can, because they
power it's to the
exactly it's what, because the landowner is being a nuisance, so you can file a nuisance clause around against them. If they're rats or grass, if you don't want to grow food, you just want to turn it into a park, you can take it for that as well. So you know, the law is on your side if you're really interested in being more resilient or self-sufficient as it comes to growing food or creating green spaces, being more sustainable. There are tons that you can do. There are different organizations out there. You know, there are a few collectives. So I mean, if you're interested, you can contact me or go on the Baltimore City website. You can go on the Farm Alliance website, which is the organization that we're a part of now, which is a group of about 25 urban farms that connect to share resources and make farming more sustainable in Baltimore. There's also the Beginner Farmer Training Program, which you can learn. You can get certified as a beginner farmer, and you get invited to all these cool events and workshops and enhance your skills, different conferences. There's tons out there. You just gotta, Google is your best friend. That's why.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. So just search it. It'll come up.
Why do you think it's so hard for inner city and minority groups to change from a junk food diet to something that's more healthy and more sustainable? Because one argument that I hear a lot is that it costs a lot to eat healthy. Do you agree with that?
No, it's cheaper if you cut meat out of your diet and you grow your own food.
Let's not go that crazy. Let's not go that far.
I respect it. I still eat meat.
Okay.
However sparingly it is, I still technically eat meat.
Right.
But I think the biggest barrier is not so much finances, but willingness.
Right.
And there's a book, what is it called? Sugar, Salt, and Fat.
I think that's what it's called.
So that book pretty much, you know, I obviously haven't read it, so I'm not even going to tell you what it's about, but just the name alone can tell you where it touches on. It's basically about how foods have been engineered to make us addicted to them. So the biggest barrier to transitioning to a health food diet is replacing the ratios of sugar, salt, and fat that you're getting in junk food, because there are scientists and millions of dollars on the side of all of these companies. So down to the color, you know, the taste, the way that it hits your tongue, you know, the way that it hits your palate and all the different zones that it touches while you're eating it.
All
of that has been engineered. And
yeah,
so
have you heard of the documentary Fed Up?
Yeah.
I watched that and it was saying the same thing, that millions and millions of dollars are just really spent on not even marketing. It's just spent on the science behind getting you addicted to food.
Exactly.
And not healthy food, but getting you addicted
exactly.
to like Cheetos and ice cream and stuff like that.
But and they're good at it.
I'll admit that ice cream is good. I love ice cream.
I love ice cream too. they're super good at it. So, you know, when you go to transition to a healthier food, your body still craves those same things. So if you don't make sure that you're getting enough fat in your day, that you're not you're getting enough salt, and you're getting the proper and the right types of sugar, because your body needs all of those things.
Right.
So it's not the fact that it's in the food that's bad. It's, you know, the fact that the types that you're getting are not are the kinds that either will get into your body and wreak havoc, or will not dissolve well. It won't carry nutrients like they're supposed to. So, you know, I think that's what the biggest barrier is, because people will pay for what they want. Because last time I checked, a bag of Doritos is like $5 in the grocery store. And I can buy a bag of rice and like make that last for some meals, you know.
That's
and
true.
those Doritos will be gone in the next 2 days. So it's not that it's more expensive to eat healthy. It's actually more expensive to eat junk. Like, have you seen the price of like Oreos and, you know, soda? Like all this stuff is way more expensive than water and like whole grains, you know, vegetables, even lean meats. You know, I mean, you can eat meat. That's all up to you, you know. But when you go from buying a regular ground beef or ground chuck, whatever you buy, to the pre-packaged patties, then your cost goes up. So it's the processed food that's more expensive. But because we've been, you know, trained to be addicted to those foods, it's more expensive in terms of time and effort to eat healthy than it is, you know, to eat like processed foods that are terrible for your body.
Would you consider yourself a localvore?
Let's see. I'm like a seasonal local for. Even though I had a really good winter last year that I canned and froze a lot of my vegetables that I grew. And I've been canning and freezing periodically throughout the summer this year. So yeah, I eat local whenever it's possible. Unless I'm boycotting that restaurant or or enterprise.
Unless you're on a crusade.
Unless I'm on a crusade, because, you know, for me, there it's about the ethics of food.
Right.
You know, and I'm not going to compromise my values to go toward a business that I don't support, you know. So if their customer service isn't good, if they, you know, if they do something that I don't like, I'm going to boycott them, just like the big companies, because that business doesn't need to stay open any more, you know, than the huge ones do.
Right. What's your favorite restaurant right now?
My favorite restaurant? I don't know, because I'm very disappointed with Baltimore restaurant culture and
scene.
Really?
Ooh, okay.
I've been having some real issues eating, getting food. Like any restaurant, I tried to go out for dinner last night, and not really dinner. It was like I wanted food and it was late, and there was nothing open to accommodate me. Like everything that's open late night is either junk food or bland or overpriced and ridiculous,
right.
You know, nothing that I really wanted to go to. And so I woke up this morning still hungry because I just decided not to eat last night.
I'm just going to go to sleep.
Exactly. Like, you know, this is taking hours out of my life. Whatever. I'm just going to go to sleep. So then I wake up this morning and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go get breakfast. This is great. There was no breakfast places open either. I'm like, what is going on? But obviously this was like in walking distance of where I was at. So, you know, it's not largely, by and large, but I'm just not finding, like, a lot of the locavore restaurants here in Baltimore are really high meat based, you know, so they'll have like, it's really cool to have like rabbit and like deer and swine and all these things on the menu, all things that I just do not eat, you know? And so it's like, so the vegetarian options will be lacking, or it's super expensive. So I haven't found a well-priced actual local like eatery, that sells food that's culturally appropriate and that I would like.
What do you mean by culturally appropriate?
That's not a whole bunch of duck fat and everything. No, I'm just kidding. But what I mean by culturally appropriate is, I mean, appropriate to me. You know, I'm African American. I was raised, you know, African American household. And so while I don't need to be eating soul food all the time, you know, I would like to eat dishes that are more familiar to me than not. So even though, if you haven't been to Blue Tavern.
Is that in Fed Hill?
Yes.
Blue Tavern.
Yes. You got to have the smoked fried chicken.
Is it the one all the way down on Light Street with like the neon sign on the side?
It has a neon sign. It's on Hanover Street.
Oh, it's on Blue Tavern.
You've probably seen it, though.
I have, because I'm
it's
in
delicious.
That area a lot, but I've never been in. It's good?
Oh, it's good.
Okay.
It's good, but they served...
They served
fried chicken with potato salad or like something. It was like coleslaw or something like that. So that's what I mean by culturally appropriate. Like, it's fried chicken, but it's not the way that I would have it. No, I'm just kidding. but yeah, there are a lot of nice restaurants, but maybe I just live under a rock because I have not been participating in a lot of them. And when I do, I'm not very impressed by what the menus have.
Any future projects, anything like that coming up?
Future projects. I'm working on a few projects. We'll see how they play out. I think I'm going to address this whole food issue myself. So we'll see.
You're gonna strap on your hard hat and you're like, Sasha's taking care of this.
Exactly.
Okay.
No, maybe my chef's apron.
Yeah,
I might put on my chef's hat and do something about this food scene. I love food, so I don't think that I've done
all. Most people that are alive love food.
You know, there are some people that are really basic with their food. Like, I adore it, you know. I put it on a pedestal, and I treat it. I cherish food.
Okay.
I really do. I cherish my plants, and I cherish my meals when I make them. And so I don't think that I'm done with food just yet here in Baltimore or otherwise. I'm pretty excited about this Costa Rica trip. We'll see how that goes.
That was Sasha Jones, everybody, urban farmer, sustainability expert, and apparently all-around amazing person. I want to thank you guys for listening. This is Jason V, and that was Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. Find me on Twitter at localcolor410. Find me on Facebook, Local Color, a Baltimore podcast. And I don't have an Instagram yet, but, you know, I'm working on that. See you guys next week.
Yay.